Welcome to episode 9 of the Slouching Towards Thatcham podcast, a podcast which showcases the writing and voices of UK parent bloggers. I'm Tim from Slouching Towards Thatcham, a blog about life as a father of three young children. On each week's podcast, I talk to a fellow parent blogger who talks about and reads one of their favourite posts, and I do the same with one of mine. It's as simple as that, bite-sized chunks of blogging brilliance. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by father of two and freelance writer Julian from the blog Northern Dad, winner of Best Writer at the 2015 Brit Mums Brilliance in Blogging Awards. Hi there, Julian.
Hi, Tim.
So, to start with, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, your family, and your blog?
I'm a frustrated sitcom writer, Tim. So what I try and do with my blog is pitch it as a sitcom. So like a mini-com in 500 words. And I also used to do a bit of work for Viz. So I try and pitch it between those two spheres. So you might find you get a 500-word piece and then something a bit more short and zesty. So I'm married with two kids. My daughter's six and she's super cute. And she does all the super cute little girl things. So she'll watch Ghostbusters and line up all the Beanie Boos because she wants them to enjoy it as well. And then she'll take him to bed because she might be a little bit scared as well. But she's being completely overshadowed at the moment by my son, who's 12 and is going through puberty. As a spectator sport, Tim, puberty's unrivaled. I mean that in the most normal ways possible. I'm not watching him. But as a thing, it's just unreal. There's something going off all the time. So an example of that would be a couple of weeks ago, I walked into his bedroom unannounced, which is something you should never do. I mean, knock, whistle, put symbols on your knees, whatever. Just make sure he knows you're coming. And then I went in the room and I caught him and three of his mates. And they were all huddled around the iPad watching Murder, She Wrote. I thought, what's he doing? I was expecting something else. I thought, well, this must be what testosterone does for you. It must make you do random things, either that or it's a smoke screen or something else. I remember as a kid, if I had a mucky video or anything like that, I'd write Sky at Night on it, episode 6. So maybe he's doing that, I don't know. Or maybe testosterone is making him fancy busybody granny detectives. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing, but they do it every Tuesday night. So the blog I do, the post I'm going to read, he's talking about this area between boy and man. And sometimes he's really boyish and you look after him. And other times he's pulling away and he's doing these really random things and you can't control. So I suppose it's a little bit about control.
Okay, well, that's great. So in that case, I'll hand the reins over to you. Away you go.
Thanks, Tim. From smashing pottery to group sex to devil worship in 2 minutes. But that's preteens for you. It's Thursday evening and I am watching my wife cook the tea I had promised to cook. It was a tense situation. I felt compelled to stay near her, so she knew I wasn't off enjoying myself, but this was irritating her. The tension was momentarily suspended by my 12-year-old son, who shuffled in sheepishly and delved into the fridge. He looked submissive, like he'd done something bad, and wanted to get the verbal roasting out of the way, the same look I was giving my wife. "Is something wrong?" I asked him. "Dad," he said slowly and cautiously. I mentally ran through a list of ornaments I thought he'd broken and put them in an ascending order of importance so that my reaction was proportionate. I sort of accidentally went to the woods with four girls. I was the only boy there. My wife swung round alarmingly fast and said to me, "I told you not to buy him that Lynx deodorant." We all laughed nervously. Over the past few weeks, my son has been pestering me to buy him some Lynx deodorant. Male grooming is now the natural rite of passage for most boys, and I hear that even some remote Amazonian tribes have dispensed with circumcision rituals to mark the onset of manhood, and are now giving each other Instinct by David Beckham. Watching a 12-year-old boy apply deodorant is a real eye-opener. They have absolutely no concept of what is an appropriate amount to wear on a trip to the corner shop to buy fizzy dummies. I timed him yesterday and he held down the nozzle in the spray position for a jaw-dropping 14 seconds. As a result, my house smells like the Lynx testing facility and looks like a foggy London scene from an early Sherlock Holmes film. My wife cautiously sidestepped me and positioned herself so that she could more easily waterboard my son to find out all about his trip to the woods. "What happened?" she asked in a cool mum voice, the kind of voice that would make a kid think it's okay to describe how he had sex in the woods with four girls. "It was awful," he replied. "Not what I want to hear, but at least the ornaments were still in one piece." "It's okay," comforted my wife. "What happened?" "One of them started doing black magic. They were trying to summon up this spirit to move a pencil, and it did. The pencil moved." Emotionally, I was completely drained. I'd gone from smashing pottery to group sex to devil worship in 2 minutes. But that's preteens for you. It soon got worse. My wife appointed herself chief counsellor and ushered him off to a separate room, which meant that I had to finish the tea. Later that night, I took myself into bed, turned off my wife's iPad, which was blasting a white light into her sleeping face, and then rolled over. 10 minutes later, there was an apologetic knock at the door, followed by a strong waft of links. A sheepish voice broke the fragile silence. "I'm scared," it said. "Can I sleep in here with you tonight?" I woke up my wife, which startled her. She started screeching like a possessed witch. "Trust me here, a startled wife is not something a boy needs to witness when he's looking for reassurance that demonic spirits don't exist." Eventually, we both agreed that he could sleep at the foot of the bed in a sleeping bag. My son zipped himself in tightly, as though someone had told him that spirits from the fourth dimension struggle to undo zips. I spent a long time trying to reassure him. So much time, in fact, that I was starting to get annoyed. Eventually, I sensed that he was only half reassured, so I took this as an opportunity to turn off the light. Darkness wrapped its ominous cloak around us. A few moments later, he piped up, "Dad, how do you know ghosts aren't real and they won't get me?" "Because they're all allergic to links. Now go to sleep."
Thanks, Julian. Our oldest son isn't quite 8 yet, so it's a little terrifying to think we've got conversations like this to look forward to with him.
Enjoy it. I mean, my neck hurts at the amount of times I have to look around to see what he's doing.
Yeah, some sage advice that I think I'd do well to take heed of. So thank you so much for taking the time to join me on this week's podcast.
Not a problem, Tim.
If you want to read more of Julian's writing, go to his blog Northern Dad at northerndad.wordpress.com or follow him on Twitter at northerndadblog. I'll attach blog and social media links on the show notes over on slouchingtowardsthatcham.com. Julian's post highlighted one of the range of increasingly awkward conversations we'll all inevitably have with our kids as they grow older. For my post this week, I'm harking back to another difficult conversation I had with our oldest son, Isaac, shortly before his 4th birthday, when I had to broach the topic of death with him. So this is an extract from a post called "The End of the Innocence." "I want my little boy back. It's not that I've lost Isaac as such, but there's no escaping the fact that he's no longer the innocent little toddler, which, in some way, he will always be in my mind's eye. In his place is an increasingly aware boy who is fast discovering the reality of the world he lives in, with all that's good and bad about it. It's a double-edged sword, a bittersweet moment, and although I know I have to let go of his hand at some point, I'm finding it one of the hardest things I've had to do as a parent so far. Once a child starts to lose his innocence, you cannot put the genie back into the lamp. I know it has to happen eventually, but did it have to be so soon? Over the past couple of weeks, I've watched Isaac take 2 huge strides forward on the path to adulthood. I'm going to talk about one of them here. I have a vivid memory of the first time I confronted the spectre of death as a child firsthand. I was nearly 7. My paternal grandfather in Malaysia fell gravely ill. I can remember my parents' anxiety as they hastily arranged for us to fly out at the first possible opportunity. While my parents visited his bedside in hospital, I was kept outside, and my various aunts and uncles sat with me. The first time I saw him on that trip was when I paid my respects to his lifeless body, laid out in his coffin at the family home before the funeral. I can remember details of the burial itself better than I can recall what I did last weekend. the stickiness of a hot and humid early summer's day, the stifled grief of my dad's family, the grittiness of the handful of earth I was asked to throw on the coffin. Most of all, I know that I was, by then, old enough to understand the gravity of death, and feel genuine sorrow for a relative I could barely remember. It was the first time I had stared death in the face. I'll never forget it. Isaac was barely half the age I was then, when Heather's stepfather, his Gramps, passed away on the afternoon of Remembrance Day, the 11th day of the 11th month of 2011. In the same way that my initial encounter with mortality left an indelible mark on me, so too Isaac's first brush with death has had a significant impact on him. Isaac already understood the concept of death, at least as it relates to plants and bugs. When I explained to him that Gramps was very ill in hospital and might not come home, he was emotionally developed enough to comprehend that this was a cause for great concern. We never took Isaac to see him before he passed away, but we did explain to him before the funeral that he had died, and Isaac was genuinely sad. He immediately grasped the idea that he would never see Gramps again, and commented that it doesn't feel like Nana and Gramps' house anymore. Out of the mouths of babes. Over the past few days, we've introduced him to Always and Forever, a children's book which gently broaches the subject of death, mourning, and remembrance. It's quickly become compulsory reading every night. What's amazed me is the way he's completely grasped the subject matter. Where he normally bombards me with questions whenever we read a new book, he instead sits quietly and reflectively. Unprompted, he told me the story made him sad. And when I asked him if he understood what it was about, he immediately replied, complete with a wobbly bottom lip, "Fox died, just like Gramps did." I don't think I've ever wanted to just hold my boy in my arms, hug him, and never let him go as much as I did at that moment. Last night I read the book with him, the fourth time we've done so between us. We talked about how he would never see Gramps again. He asked me about where he had gone, to which I responded with a suitably neutral, agnostic answer about being in a faraway place which we couldn't visit. He then asked me if this was because it was on a different planet, not in England, and how Gramps had managed to get all the way there in his wheelchair. With logic like that, I can see that I'm going to have to come up with a suitably convincing mathematical proof to rationalise Santa Claus in the not-so-distant future. And then he popped the killer questions. Why did Gramps die? Which was followed by, "Will I die?" as tears started welling up in his eyes. There have only been a few times in my life when I've really wanted the earth to open up and swallow me. This was one of them. I explained to him about Gramps being very old and very ill, and that he himself would be fine for a long time yet. The cogs whirled rapidly in his brain for a brief moment, and then, with tears now rolling freely down his cheeks, he uttered eight simple words that broke my heart. "Daddy, I'd really miss you if you died." I don't know whether Isaac is ahead of the curve in terms of his rational and emotional understanding of death. Actually, it really doesn't matter. All I know is that I'm simultaneously impressed and saddened that this not quite four-year-old child already knows so much. We reached the watershed moment last night. The genie is out of the lamp. The cork is out of the bottle. There is no turning back. That, even more than the thought of his Gramps' death, is what saddens me the most. There's no escaping the fact that our little boy is growing up. Isaac has reached the end of the innocence. And that's it for this episode of the Slouching Towards Thatcham podcast. If you'd like to listen to either future or previous episodes, you'll find them published on the blog, and also on iTunes and various other podcasting sites. You can follow me on the blog at slouchingtowardsthatcham.com, on Twitter at ThatchamDad, and on various other social media channels. You'll find links to all of the above, plus Julian's links, in the show notes on the blog. All that remains for me is to say thank you all for listening to this podcast, and hopefully you'll join me again next week. Until then, goodbye.